So we can actually tell you when and how long it's going to take for these trees to produce, as well as what time frame they're going to drop their fruit and nuts. So that's, you can be a little more strategic with, here's my early season, here's my mid season, and then here's my late season with chestnut, persimmon, apples, pears. So a lot of diversity versus just your neighbor who might just have the food plot and be surrounded by the cornfield.
Hey guys, welcome to the National Deer Association's Deer Season 365 podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grossman, and we got a great habitat episode lined up for you this week as we dive into the topic of planting and growing wildlife trees and shrubs. I'll be talking with Frank Brock of Morse Nursery all about choosing the right trees, when and where to plant, as well as how to plant and maintain those trees for their best odds of survival. So I know you guys are going to enjoy that. Be sure to stick around for that conversation. Hey, before we get started, though, this week's episode is brought to you by longtime NDA partner HHA Sports. With 40 years in the industry, HHA is hands down the brand of choice for movable bow sights. American-made and backed by a 100% lifetime warranty, HHA sights are packed with exclusive features that set them apart from the competition. For 2024, HHA has launched the Tetra Rise X3, featuring their most advanced multi-pin technology to date. Fully adjustable indicators allow you ultimate versatility in setting all three pins and indicators exactly where you want them. If you're in the market for a new bow sight, be sure to check out HHA at hhasports.com. Hey, one more thing before we jump on the phone with Frank. We've just launched our 2024 United for Deer Spring Sweepstakes, which as far as I know is NDA's biggest sweepstakes ever. There's going to be five winners of five big prize packages, and those packages include items like a Tracker 800SX Crew Cab UTV, a $10,000 Academy Sports and Outdoors gift card, a PH Outdoors G3 no-till drill, a premium Kentucky elk tag, an Illinois deer hunt, and much more. A ticket start at just $20, and all proceeds raised will go towards NDA's mission of ensuring the future of wild deer, wildlife habitat, and hunting. To get your tickets today, head over to deerassociation.com and look for the United for Deer Sweepstakes banner right there on our homepage. And with that, guys, let's jump on the phone with Frank Brock to discuss planting and growing wildlife trees and shrubs. Well, Frank, thanks so much for coming on the Deer Season 365 podcast to talk wildlife trees and shrubs with me.
Man, not a problem. I appreciate you having me on. Excited to get on here. I've been listening to a few episodes and excited to have a nice conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to this myself as somebody that needs to plant some wildlife trees and shrubs here on my place. So definitely looking forward to picking your brain on that. But before we do dive into the topic at hand, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe what you do and how you became interested in wildlife trees and I guess deer habitat in general?
For sure. Yeah. So my name's Frank and I'm the dedicated habitat whitetail design consultant for MorseNursery.com. We're focused completely on deer habitat, turkey habitat, anything to deal with habitat. Mainly trees and shrubs we're into. So that's really my focus is looking at fruit and nut trees as well as shrubs and building out different thicket areas and just really overall property improvement for the habitat.
Okay. Yeah. And where are you guys out of?
We have two locations. So the majority of our genetics are out of our Michigan location, which makes us a little more cold hardy. But we also have a location in West Lafayette, Indiana. And then we ship nationwide. So we cover the whole country.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I know, and I'm sure you're very familiar with this. When you bring up the topic of managing a property for deer, I think the first thing that comes to mind for most people are food plots. Us deer hunters love our food plots, but why should we consider spending our time and resources planning trees and shrubs, you know, beyond just food plots themselves?
Great question. And, you know, I love my food plots too. I can't lie. The one thing that makes a majority of difference between a tree planting and a food plot is you're looking at a one-time plant. And if you do that planting right with a tree, and our genetics, at least, are 3 to 5 years of age, they'll start to produce. And then every year after that, you'll get a bigger crop until they reach full maturity. So you're putting a little bit of effort in, you know, one initial planting, and it's going to produce for you and maybe even your grandkids moving forward. Now, the big thing with, besides just maintenance and doing a food plot every year, is with the trees, we have it down to a science where our genetics, we have them all in Michigan. So we can actually tell you when and how long it's going to take for these trees to produce, as well as what time frame they're going to drop their fruit and nuts. So that's, you can be a little more strategic with, here's my early season, here's my mid season, and then here's my late season with chestnut, persimmon, apples, pears. So a lot of diversity versus just your neighbor who might just have the food plot and be surrounded by the cornfield. Now, our big approach to that though is let's combine these two things to make the most. So we really like to do clover plots around our tree bases because it provides a nice nitrogen to the roots of the trees. It helps invigorate growth, and it's a food plot. So kind of best of both worlds and a great way to kind of mesh your current food plots and enhance it with some trees.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you hit the key word there. I think it's all about diversity because, you know, sometimes food plots fail. You don't get the rain you needed or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, they just don't produce. And, you know, those trees are going to be there year after year once you get them established. And, yeah, so it's good, like you said, to have that diversity for when one doesn't produce like it should. Hopefully the other one does.
The running joke around me with a lot of my clients is I always laugh about it, but none of my neighbors know what I do for a living. And that's by design. That way they're not planting persimmon and chestnuts on their property and I can have a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. There you go. And I guess, you know, then the next question for me is, you know, once I've decided, hey, I do need some wildlife trees on my property, trees or shrubs, which in my case I do. I know some of the listeners or any of the listeners who's listened for very long know that, you know, I have a small property here that I'm trying to manage for deer and wildlife, and tree plantings is definitely on the list. And I've just a couple here and there, but definitely need to do some more. I guess, how do you go about deciding, you know, what to plant? Obviously, you know, that's going to vary from property to property, but what are some considerations there as a property owner might try to decide, you know, what exactly he needs to plant species wise?
For sure. Yeah. Now, we work with some different biologists that formerly work with the USDA and stuff like that. So this isn't from me directly, but our list of top five fruit and nut trees that we push, chestnuts number one. They can thrive here in America as long as you have a well-drained soil. So that's number one. Persimmon or two, if you can get that self-pollinating female versus having to worry about a male and a female going on. And then number three would be pears. And then after that, you got apples, crab apples, white oaks, and then red oaks. So first, you want to look at your property and kind of see what you already have going on. Do you have some old farm apple trees that are dropping in August, September? Do you have any oaks, white oaks, red oaks that are giving you some kind of crop? And, you know, are you an island property? Are you surrounded by woods? Are you surrounded by cornfields? Kind of want to understand what kind of food is around you already. And then you can play off that with our different varieties. So how I mentioned earlier, we have all the genetics in Michigan. So we literally can tell you, you know, from August to September, we can put these apples with this pear. From October to November, we can do these chestnuts with these persimmon. And then we can get you with some more even late drop apples later in the season. So it really depends on each individual case. But if you're going to start anywhere, my big three are chestnut, persimmon, and pears. And that's just because it's going to create the most diversity on your property right away. So in 3 to 5 years of age, you're going to start getting production. And then what's going to differentiate you is when it's dropping. So typically, if you're surrounded by corn, or, you know, you buy just a local apple tree from the big box store, it's going to be more of an early season apple, also more of a dwarf tree, so a smaller tree. So it's not going to provide a huge amount of food. On top of, if you have the corn nearby, that's just a massive food plot, right? So if we can provide food sources after that corn crop's gone, or after your apples stop dropping, or your neighbor's apples stop dropping, you know, you're going to be that much more efficient. And also, like you touched on it earlier, is the diversity. That's the biggest key. If we can diversify, and not only diversify, but provide a better food source versus just your rye and your oats and like a food plot mix or clover, we can provide something with nutritional value, with carbs, proteins, sugars that they're really going to want, especially after the rut when they've been running themselves into the ground. If your property can provide not only nutrition, better tasting food, and then we can build out some different shrubs that provide summer foliage in a late season thicket, it kind of all wraps in together. And again, my favorite part of it is it's a one-time plant. And with our system, we have a lot of clients who don't live on their properties. They're kind of off-site, just a hunting recreational property. So we set them up in our tree survival kits, which is a tree tube, a weed mat, a two-year fertilizer pack, and we put a one-year warranty on it. We do that because it not only keeps the wind off, it keeps the deer rubbing browse off. Our weed mat's going to give you 4 to 6 weeks of moisture control. And also the fertilizer pack leaches out over 2 years. So we're essentially giving you something that's maintenance free, as we have like a 94% success rate in these kits that you can just put out there and kind of let nature do its job. Because I know a lot of people get scared when you start thinking trees and shrubs and it's, oh, I got to build a wire fence around it, or I'm not really sure how to take care of these. But there's really a good way to do it and a maintenance free way to do it that is going to be successful for you.
Okay. Yeah, we'll definitely get into some of that as far as the planning process and the maintenance, yeah, and that kind of thing as well. Now you touched on something there that, you know, I think a lot of hunters may be aware of, but some may not be, like with the persimmon thing, is that there are, with some fruit trees like that, there are, you know, male and female trees, and not every tree produces fruit. I've seen that here on my property. I've identified several persimmon trees. A few had three together when I first moved on the property. I was excited to find these three big persimmon trees, and then quickly realized that none of them produce fruit because they're all three male trees. But can you talk a little bit about that? You know, persimmons, are there other fruit trees that's a consideration with as well?
It is, yeah. So something to note, and I'll explain that and explain the persimmon thing. So we have some other persimmon trees that are known self-pollinating females. So we actually graft directly from them to give you guys an identical clone. And that means it doesn't need a male to produce. Now, if it's in the presence of a male, it'll produce more, but it's truly a self-pollinator. So that's where the water gets kind of muddy, is with like persimmon seedlings. So if you grow persimmon from seed, there's an 80% chance. So if we put 100 seedlings in the ground, there's an 80% chance that they will be males, 80% of them. And the other 20% might be female. And you obviously need both of those for a wild persimmon to actually produce. So that's why I always kind of push people away from just buying persimmon seedlings. You can get them usually pretty cheap, maybe on like a Facebook marketplace or something like that. But you're going to be playing the long waiting game because there's no really way to tell if it's a male or a female until they grow up. So if I can push you more towards something that's a genetic grafted clone that is a self-pollinator, which we also have like some pear self-pollinators too, it's just less work and less worry that you're not going to get a crop long term.
Yeah. Yep. And like I said, it's definitely something I have to address here on my place. So persimmons, you mentioned pears there. Are there other trees that where you have male and female individuals, I guess?
Yeah. So we also have a kefir and a hybrid pear that are both self-pollinating. But if you're looking like apples, you need to put those in twos or threes. Typically, you need the crab apple in the mix for every 9 apples. And that's just for pollination purposes. Same with chestnuts. You want to have those in pairs or threes as well, because they do cross-pollinate. But with the persimmon and the pears, we can give you a self-pollinating option. And what that gets really fun with is you can be a little more strategic with the placement of those trees on the property, because you only need one of them.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. And, you know, I noticed a lot of those fruit trees are offered in, you know, different varieties, a lot of different names. you know, what, I guess, what are some of the differences in those varieties, and, you know, what makes one, I guess, better than the other as far as for deer and wildlife?
Yeah. So I kind of mentioned earlier too, but, you know, we have all these different varieties and we have it down to where we know which drop in August, September, October, November, all the way into January. So the more and longer time we can have food on the ground, the better. So when I'm setting up a property, I typically like to find an area of not a lot of pressure that we can make more of an August, September kind of plot that, you know, is a staging area where they can get a good taste of the food and not have pressure. And then once that food stops dropping in September, now we have more of a mid-season area that's October through early December. And then we can do the same thing with the late season of, you know, December into early February. So if we can kind of stage them out, it can help make our hunting a little more predictable, because what happens is these deer come and they check these trees. Sometimes in Michigan, we have them come back to the same trees three times a day. And for instance, that's our Enterprise apple tree. So I have trail cam pics of them coming in the morning, coming in mid-afternoon, and then coming back at night. And it's constant. So again, they know it's there. And then it's all about, when is the food on the ground? If we can have food on the ground from August all the way to December, you can bet those deers are going to keep frequently visiting your property. And that's just really the first step to make the most change on it. On top of, like we mentioned, you know, putting the clover around the trees too, and now you have a food plot there as well. So kind of the double, triple threat kind of idea.
Okay. So one of the big things as far as the different varieties is when they're going to fruit. Any other things, I guess, impacted by those different varieties, any other traits of the trees?
Yeah. And the next step would be, like, so a lot of the apples that I push you to go towards, like our Enterprise, our Gold Rush, Arkansas Black, Liberty, they're disease resistant varieties. So we don't want you going out there and having to spray it. Like, let's say a Honeycrisp, you got to spray it for disease and you got to spray it for bugs. If I get you set up with disease resistant options, it's not a lot of work going into it besides the initial planting. So that's something also to think about. Even with chestnuts, you know, you want to make sure your chestnuts are blight resistant. That's a huge factor in success with those as well. But it really just comes down to making sure, again, you have disease resistance and then figuring out how you can be strategic of when the fruit are dropping. Because if you go out and buy a couple apple trees, it could all be early season and it won't really affect your hunting. You're just going to feed the deer for someone else.
So are you, it sounds like then you definitely want to look at, or at least in some cases, you want a mixture of those varieties. So I guess specifically to kind of time the different fruit drops across the season. Is that what I'm hearing? I mean, you probably, in most cases, you're not going to want to just stick with one variety. You're going to want a mixture.
Correct. Yeah. The more different options we can provide, the more diverse it's going to be. You know, going from a 1-star hotel to a 4-star hotel is going to make a big difference. So if we can provide nice amenities, we'll hopefully can hold the deer a little longer.
Gotcha. And what's the difference between, you know, I know we've talked about varieties, but then you also hear mentions of different root stock.
Yeah.
What is the difference between, you know, a variety, a different varieties and different root stock?
So it depends. So basically our chestnut and oaks are grown from seed, so no rootstock needed on those. But when it comes to our fruit producers, like our apple, persimmon, and pears, we are grafting those. So the reason we graft them is because you're getting a genetic clone of that tree. But what is very important is the rootstock. So for our fruit, our apple trees, we only use standard M111 rootstock. It's a more disease-resistant rootstock. It's better for drier areas if it has to kind of go into those situations. But the standard part of it is it's going to produce a larger habitat like tree. So we're looking at apple and pear trees that are going to get into that 25, 30 foot range, versus if you have a dwarf rootstock tree, which is your typical like apple orchard tree, it's going to be a lot smaller. We're talking 12 to maybe 17 foot. And it's meant like that so that like workers in an orchard, commercial orchard, don't have to get on top of ladders and climb as high. It's easier to pick. But that also applies. I don't know, you know, some of the listeners probably have, you know, dwarf trees on their farm. And I've seen one of my old dwarf trees that was originally here. The deer will stand up and actually eat all around the tree as much as they can. So if we can provide a bigger tree it's going to provide a longer time of the fruit dropping. So you can actually continue to have them come back because they can't reach it all at once.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Well, now that we have some ideas, and well, I guess one other thing with your your chestnuts, what are those? Are those some type of hybrid, or what are those? What type of chestnuts do you guys are you recommending to plant?
We have American hybrids, we have Chinese, we even have some European Japanese crosses. The big difference with our chestnuts is they're going to be more cold hardy versus ones that are grown down south. That's why we do a lot of business up in like the Wisconsin, upper New York, Pennsylvania, stuff like that, because we're more cold hardy to the environment. That doesn't mean the trees can't go south. They can, but typically southern trees usually can't come north. So we like to stick with the American hybrids just because of the blight as well. And also our Chinese, and like I mentioned, it's called La Roca. It's a European Japanese cross. And we like those varieties because they're big producers and we get production in 3 to 5 years of age.
Okay. Good to know. And that's that 3 to 5 years is planting them as what is that, a planting a potted tree, or is that planting them from seedling, or what?
Yeah. So that's just of the age of the tree. So if I give you a 1 year old.
Oh, I got you. And then.
Okay. Yeah. In the next 2-3 years, you could have a crop. It won't be big the first year. So typically for chestnuts, it's around a pound per tree by years 4 to 6. It doubles every year after that until you reach the full maturity of like age 15.
Okay, gotcha. Now that we have covered as far as some ideas of what to plant, let's kind of dive into where to plant. So what factors should you consider when you're deciding, you know, where exactly on your property you want to put these trees?
Yeah, and so typically a good reference point is if you already have food plots on the property, that's typically a good place to start. And you can throw a few in those food plots, maybe expand them a little bit or to let more light in. But the main factor you want to think about with trees is full sun is best. But if you can't get full sun, then half day is okay as long as it's morning sun. That sun's a little better for the trees, and they do fine if it's half day. So finding a spot with the most sun or morning half day sun, and then figuring out, you know, what kind of soil you have. Now, I like to push a lot of people to local universities like the Penn State Extension, Michigan State for soil samples, or your local university or someone you know that's local to the area. That way they're more familiar with what's going on around you and you can get a better idea, you know, of what's going to work in that area. Like, so each tree is a little different. The most finicky one is the chestnut, and it typically just needs a well-drained soil. So as long as it's well-drained, it's not holding moisture for more than 24, 48 hours, like standing water, then you're just fine. A lot of the other things can handle, like persimmon and prepares can be in a little wetter feet, not soaked. But then it also just, again, it depends on the variety. So we have like 13 different types of white oak, for instance, and about 6 of those are crossed with a swamp white oak. So those kind of trees can be in the wetter areas too, you know, kind of fill your creek side, stuff like that. So it really comes down to case by case, but always start with a good soil sample if you can to figure out what you got going on. And you can always enrich that soil to make it good for the trees.
Yeah. Are you better off kind of scattering trees, I guess, you know, across your property throughout the property, or do you recommend planting them together in more of an orchard scenario, I guess, if you have the open areas?
Yeah, so good question. So when I do a design for someone, like I'm out to their property, we really want to locate multiple different destinations that we can do smaller clusters. So maybe it's a cluster of 8 trees, maybe it's a cluster of 16 trees, but we can put it on as like a mini orchard on 20-25 foot centers that becomes a destination versus just taking 1 acre and filling the whole thing up with trees on 20-foot centers. Yeah, you're going to have 134 producing trees, but now the deer can just kind of window shop and come to the first 3 rows of that orchard. And there's no reason for them to cross it because they're getting everything they need right there. So that's why I like to have different areas with different like little tree clusters or mini orchards. And that's where we can get into, hey, let's have this one be a early season. Let's have this one be a mid season. Let's have this one be a late season kind of kill plot, for instance.
Okay. And those clusters are going to be of like similar trees, or are you going to, even within a cluster, are you going to have different types of trees in there?
So the only thing you got to worry about with that is the size of the mature tree, because you don't want to plant something with something else that's going to eventually shade it out. So I like to usually keep apples and pears, crab apples together. And then I like to do like chestnut and persimmon together as well, because they're similar heights at maturity.
Okay. Gotcha. And then I guess the next question in that is kind of how do you decide how many trees you need to plant on any given property?
That's a good question. It's always kind of always what, how much you want to bite off, because you do got to plant them. Right. Don't forget about that. Typically a first year guy, it depends on the property size, areas you have available. But for instance, 10 trees on 20-foot centers usually covers around 4,000 square feet. So it's not going to take up as much space as you really think. But it's going to, again, provide an everlasting food source that's going to be different than that food plot you plant every year.
Okay. So just kind of, I guess, start with what you can handle and go from there then.
Yeah, correct. And the other thing to think about too, Brian, is, you know, if we send you a potted tree, that tree doesn't have to be in the ground in 7 days. You know, you can kind of handle that tree and take care of it as long as the roots don't dry out. And you can plant kind of at your leisure as well.
Okay, gotcha.
And then something else we haven't touched on yet, but just to mention, a good idea to kind of figure out in your area when you should plant your trees is we like to send people a live tree, so leafed out, green, after the last chance of frost in your area. And typically when we get someone a live tree and then avoids the frost, we see an extreme amount of growth in the first year. If you do get hit by a frost, it's not going to kill the tree, but it's definitely going to stunt that first year's growth. So like, for instance, someone in Michigan, we usually typically wait on them until the first or second week of May, versus someone, you know, down in North Carolina, we can start shipping to them right now or even late February. So it really just depends on your area, but you just want to avoid that kind of late frost if possible.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's that. You kind of, that was a great segue into that's what I wanted to talk about next, was the actual planting process. Well, I guess before I do, any other considerations as far as things people would need to think about as far as where to plant these wildlife trees? Anything we didn't touch on?
No, I think we touched on most of it for the where to plant. Again, it kind of just depends on your location, but the main factor for production is sunlight. The more sun you get, the more your trees will produce. So that's probably the number one factor to remember.
Hey, I wanted to take just a quick break from the interview to let you know that the work we do at the National Deer Association wouldn't be possible without the support from partners like Johnny Morris, Bass Pro Shops, and Cabela's, and their customers throughout North America. A grant from the Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's Outdoor Fund is supporting the NDA's national initiative called Improving Access, Habitat, and Deer Hunting on Public Lands, with a goal of improving 1 million acres of federal and state controlled lands by 2026. This grant is directly accelerating work in this initiative to address forest vigor and access issues in 6 states. In the end, this will address declines in deer hunter numbers, habitat quality, and hunter access, helping to improve wildlife conservation for generations to come. Now back to the show. So getting into the planting side of things, I guess what's the best, what's the best size to plant? You've mentioned seedlings, you've mentioned potted plants. When would you choose, I guess, one over the other, and what's the best practice there?
So I'll be honest, a lot of people see a tall tree and they're gravitated towards it. I'd rather sell you a 1 or 2 year old tree. And the reason is transplant shock. If I can get you a 1 or 2 year old tree, the roots aren't as developed yet, aren't as complex as, let's say, a 3 to 5 year old tree. So there's a higher chance of a transplant shock if I sell you a bigger tree, for instance, which a 3 year old we sell typically is like 6 to 10 foot tall, and a 1 year old is 1 to 2 foot. But if I take that 1 year old tree and I put it in a tree tube or our survival kit, like I mentioned earlier, our tree tube, weed mat, fertilizer pack, that 1 to 2 foot tree can get out of that 5 foot tube in the first year. And I've seen it where the 1 year olds and 2 year olds will catch a 3 year old just based off transplant shock. So I'd rather sell you a younger tree, save you some money, and then have you put it in a kit and do it the right way versus you going out there and planting a bunch of trees and telling yourself you're eventually going to thin them out. I'd rather do it right the first time with you. That way it's an everlasting thing.
Okay. Gotcha. What about as far, I mean, are you selling like bare root seedlings or is that?
It depends. Yeah. So we're selling genetics. That's our big thing. So we have bare root and potted, but the big thing is you're getting our genetics that are on our Michigan location property. And they're going to do what we tell you they're going to do. So I have no preference when it comes to bare root or potted. If you're doing an acre of commercial chestnuts, I'd probably go bare root because it's going to take a lot of time to plant a bunch of potted trees. But if you're just doing your hunting farm, either one works. We typically have chestnut and oak in the bare root option in the spring. And all of our fruit trees, since they're grafted, they're in pots.
Yeah.
So we graft the rootstock in the pot.
Okay. Well, kind of, I guess, all right, we've chosen our location. We've picked up some trees. Kind of walk us through, and we'll talk about the potted plants first, or the potted trees first, but kind of walk us through that planting process, you know, starting with site prep and, you know, to the final finishing touches. What do we need to do to ensure that tree survives?
For sure. Yeah. So I'd push anyone that if you're not buying a tree from Morse and you buy a tree from somewhere else, you need to get that tree in a tube of some kind. We use a company called Tree Pro for our survival kits. And the reason we do is they're American made, but we just have such success. You know, the old fashioned way is to put a cage around something. The problem is a cage doesn't keep the wind off. And any wind over 7 miles an hour can actually stop photosynthesis or growth in a young tree. And it could be for a day, it could be for a week, it could be for a month. We really don't know. It depends on how often the wind's hitting that tree. So if I can get a tree planted in a tube, it'll stay in a constant state of growth inside that tube. And then you can leave that tube on until the tree gets to the full diameter of it. That way you don't have deer rubbing it and doing other things as well. So looking at like tubes and caging, that's why I would push you more towards tubes, less maintenance for yourself. When it comes to like site prep, typically we like to either scalp the area. So on a low maintenance side, if you have a weed eater, you can go out there and tear the ground up with that. On the high side, you know, you can come through and spray chemicals if you need to really clear that area out. And then you're good to come through and plant, obviously, once that stuff's dead around it. Now, to maintain that nice area around the tree, we recommend our 3x3 foot weed mat. And the reason we do is because it's a double-sided UV plastic. And that plastic doesn't allow moisture to evaporate out. There's no holes in it. So not only are you keeping the weeds down, the area you already prepped, but it's also going to allow any fresh rain that comes in to hold moisture anywhere from 5 to 7 weeks at a time. So by doing the tube and the weed mat on any tree planting is going to help not only with protection of the tree, obviously, it's going to help with your weed control. It's going to help with moisture control, so you're not watering as much. And then the fertilizer pack that we use actually releases over 2 years. So every time that rain or moisture gets trapped under the mat, it's going to slow release fertilizer to the tree. A young tree can only absorb so much fertilizer in the first years, or you can actually burn the roots up of the tree. When in reality, you're just trying to, you know, give the tree what it needs to survive. So we have our system that we follow, and I always push all my private landowners that I do plans for to follow. That way they're not going out there having to baby these trees as much, as well as repairing a fence or something of that nature. So as long as you're going through that, as you know, site prep, as clear out what's there existing, come in with your, you know, a normal hole for a tree, and then come in with our kit. On top of that, come around and do a broadcast of clover, or spread some clover out to provide some nitrogen to the roots and create a food plot. And you're on your way to really good success, because we have a 94% success rate with our kits, and that's why we put the 1 year warranty on them.
Okay. As far as digging the hole, well, this is,
yeah.
I know it sounds like a simple task, but it's one thing I always struggle with as far as like, you know, how big does this thing need to be across? How deep does it need to be? You know,
yeah.
Does that root ball need to be, you know, even with the ground or below the ground level? What kind of walk us through that part of it?
Yeah. So if it's a potted tree, you can typically use the size of the pot as a good estimate for your hole size. If it's a bare root tree, it's not going to be as big of a hole. You're just going to have to go around that root system. So you want to make sure you're going up to the neck of the tree where it turns into the caliper of the trunk. And you can visually see that on a bare root tree. where the roots turn into trunk, and you want to go right up to that point. If it's a potted tree, it's kind of already laid out for you where that neck of the tree is. So like for our instance, our pots are air prune pots, and you're able just to slide that right into the hole and just tear the side off. So you can make a hole. I like to use a post hole digger or even just a hand shovel. If you're going bare root and you're doing a lot of trees, the way to go is a tree planter. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you can put 1,000 trees in a couple hours versus, you know, hand digging. So it really kind of depends on the application. But if you have a skid steer, for instance, a 6 to 9 inch auger is perfect. So that's the other thing to think about too is, you know, there's don't work harder, work smarter.
Yeah, gotcha. And do you need to, I mean, like the soil under, you dig your hole deep enough, I get that, to where, you know, the dirt is level with where it was at the top of your potted plant. But what about, do you need to, you know, break up that soil underneath? Does it need to be loose or does that matter?
It just depends. If it's a clay, you can try. You just don't want to make a bowl in the clay. That way it doesn't hold water below it. The other thing to think about is, you know, a lot of people like to bring in another soil mix to kind of baby that tree's root systems. Well, we've done a project before where we came back, like science projects, where we came back to dig up certain areas and that we put in a nice peat, topsoil, sandy loam mix, and the roots never left that area, that 3x3 area. So my kind of thought behind it is I like to put my trees, unless it's a poor soil and you have to do that, I like to put my trees in the ground that I dig up. That way there's less chance of a shock and they have to get used to that area versus babying them and they'll stay in that same spot and just enjoy that nice soil, if you follow me.
Yep, gotcha. Yep. And I know on these freshly planted trees that, you know, the watering is critical or the right amount of moisture. So what are some, I guess, guidelines for watering these trees at planting and then afterwards?
Yeah, so always good to water in really well as you plant. The one thing, again, like we typically push everyone towards our kits because of the weed mat. And again, it's going to give you 4 to 7 weeks of moisture control as long as you're getting fresh rain, which stops you from having to go out there all the time, especially if you don't live by the property. So as long as you're getting consistent rain every 4 weeks, there's not much you need to do to them. I typically don't even water my trees as long as the rain's consistent. But if you don't have mat, for instance, if you don't have a survival kit, you do need to go out there if you're not getting fresh rain, probably every 2 to 3 weeks, especially in year one. Because if you can get that tree through year one successfully, it's going to have a very high chance of surviving long term. It's usually that first year that makes or breaks it.
Gotcha. And I know you've mentioned, you know, the fertilizer mat that you guys have that you can put down on the new tree. To where it'll distribute that fertilizer over time. But, you know, say for the guy that doesn't have that, he's planted a tree.
Yep.
Do you need to fertilize newly planted trees? And if so, what would you recommend, you know, for somebody that doesn't have access to that fertilizer mat?
So you can use different types, like a 12-12-12, or just different fertilizers in general. But again, you don't want to overdo it on a young tree. So typically I tell that person, you know, maybe not even do it the first year. Maybe look at more so the second year after the tree's more established. And then you want to make sure you're putting that fertilizer, not around the base of the tree, but where those roots are going to be reaching to. That way you can continue to get those roots to reach out. Because the stronger the root system, the stronger the tree. That's always what we got to remember. So if you don't have like a mat, some special mat or anything, you don't have any type of fertilizer, I wouldn't go hog wild on it because you can literally burn the roots up. So kind of letting that tree get established. And that's why I always tell people, do clover. Before you do fertilizer, put clover on the ground around the tree. And that will go miles for what you're trying to accomplish and also the health of the tree.
Gotcha. And then you already mentioned, of course, putting these in tree tubes.
Yep.
And those are, you're talking like the solid plastic ones, right? Because I've seen them with holes in them and stuff. You talking just like a solid plastic tree tube?
So the ones we use are from Tree Pro. And the reason we use them is because they have a 5 foot tube that's also 5 inches in diameter. And the 5 inch diameter is really key for any fruit or nut tree. If you get a smaller diameter than that, it can cause more like a petri dish effect because it's too thin for the tree to kind of breathe. And you want to make sure you have like a translucent product. So these Tree Pro ones we use are recycled milk jugs is what they make them out of. And so they're translucent to let the light through. You never want to use like the corrugated black piping or something that's just straight solid like PVC, because it will kill the tree over time. You want light to be able to pass through. And you also, we put, there's vents on top of those tubes. So it allows airflow as well. So you want to have that in there going on too. You just don't, anyone that puts it in like a black corrugated might work for a while, but at the bottom of that tree, I bet it's getting torn up pretty bad. It's just not letting the sun through and it's just elevating the heat around the trunk.
Okay. Gotcha. You know, before we move on to some maintenance stuff, what would you say are is the, or some of the biggest mistakes that people make when they first, you know, attempt planting trees?
Their number one mistake is just putting the tree out there and thinking nothing's going to get to it. Because the deer, if it's not protected, even if you don't have a tube and then you don't put a cage around it, the deer will eat that thing to the ground. So, and they will, they really will. And they'll eat it all the way to the ground. So like for instance, our shrubs, we put in a 3-foot tube. That way the deer can actively browse it, but they can't eat it to the ground. So that's the biggest factor, is just protecting it from the deer. And then on top of it would be like, you know, if you're just doing a cage, I'd really push someone to look towards using a tube because it's keeping the wind off. And again, we see our 1-year-old trees get out of that 5-foot tube, usually in the first growing season. So just being prepared for, you know, what could happen. Wind, deer browse, drought are the big factors.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, I don't have a ton of tree planting experience, but what little bit I've done, it seems like it doesn't matter how many trees are around, the one that you plant's the one that deer's, that buck's going to choose to rub his antlers on every single time. I don't know if it's just because it's new or what, but yeah, they seem to like to tear up them planted trees.
Smart. They wait a little bit because it's going to feed them, but yeah. You know how they are.
That's right. No patience.
No patience.
All right. Well, we've kind of walked through picking our area, picking our trees, now planting the trees. Once we've done that, we've done our trees and let's say they've survived that first year. What are some of the primary concerns or issues that you might have to deal with that could, you know, impact the future success of those trees? What's some things you got to kind of keep an eye on once you've got them planted?
Yeah. One of the biggest things is as they get older, especially for the fruit trees, like the apples, the pears, and the crab apples, is just knowing how to prune. You're typically not going to do that in the first 3 to 4 years. Just because you want the tree to get out of the 5-foot tube and then it will start to reach out. But once you get to that point where the tree is starting to have a lot of wild branches on it, there's two kind of branches you need to focus on getting rid of to promote like a bigger habitat tree. Now, any downward branch when the tree is dormant, I would cut that around years 4 to 6. And you can redo this process every 2 years, what I typically do for my trees. But any downward branches or any inward branches. And if we can get rid of those, it's going to provide more energy to the better lateral branches that we're looking to create and more upward branches long-term. So I'm not even joking. If you have like a dead branch on a tree, let's say part of your apple tree has some issues and there's two sections that are kind of dead. You want to remove those because the roots are still sending energy to those areas for nothing. So if you can remove those areas, now the tree and nature and its beauty is going to send that energy to different parts of the tree to grow taller or, you know, put on more mass or more production. So here's a good example too. So trees produce really early, like 3 to 5 years of age, like I mentioned. So if I were to send you an apple tree and it produced in year 3, I would say, you know what, let the bees find the flowers and pollinate them. But then once you start to see the little apples growing, you need to remove those. And the reason you want to remove those is the same thing I was just explaining. If you can remove those apples, your mom probably only going to get about 4 to 5 apples total. When instead, if you remove them, all that energy could go into another 3 to 4 foot of growth on that young tree. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So then we're better set up 5 and 6 for a bigger crop.
Okay. And would you just do that for kind of that first year fruiting or maybe first couple years or?
I'd say the first 1 or 2 years, depending on how strong your tree is, because what can happen is you get 1 or 2 apples on there and a big old fat climb up and get that apple and he'll break a bunch of your branches. So it's something you want to avoid. And then also just in the name of creating a bigger habitat tree too.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And then what about as far as, I guess, you know, controlling, spraying, controlling weeds around those trees? Is that something that needs to be done, you know, what after that first year or once they get up out of the tube, are they good?
Good question. You want to, so typically for like the weed control kind of deal, that's why we do the clover. So you can come through and top that. Your weed control is really important on the perimeter of your plot. Because if you can create kind of some space in between there, it's, you know, also what we do, it's kind of funny, is we put the taller wood stakes where it's like a 7 or 8 foot kind of perch for owls and hawks. So, because what can happen is mice can try to get in your tubes and girdle your trees. So if you can set up some areas where the hawks can rest and the owls at night can rest, they will keep that area clean of like the varmints for you. So that's something to be aware of. You can kind of let nature help. But when it comes to the tubes in general, you're actually going to leave the trees in that tube until it gets to the trunk, gets to the full 5-inch diameter of the tube. And the reason you do that is that way the deer like love to rub fruit trees.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you can leave that tube on until the tree gets to about 5 or 8 years old. And then you can actually take another another tube and you can put them together for a 10-inch diameter. That way, if you're not looking to have them, keep rubbing it. But that we leave our trees in those tubes until they can't fit anymore. And we have a lot of success with keeping the deer off from doing that.
Okay. Yep. Good to know. Cause that's actually, I forgot to ask you that earlier, as far as how long you're keeping them in those tubes. So, well, anything else that we haven't touched on, as far as, you know, planting and maintaining wildlife trees and shrubs, anything else that we've overlooked that the listeners might need to know?
Yeah, I wouldn't really say so. I push the listeners to check out kind of what I'm talking about with the tree survival kit on our website, just so you can get an idea of what we're talking about. And, you know, maybe you don't have access to that, like the tree survival kit, but I would look at, if you're just a guy that's caging your trees or shrubs, I look at getting them in tubes because that wind is a huge factor in the growth rates.
Okay, gotcha. And if you were going to just put a mat down of your own around a tree, what's something, I mean, what do you need to look at that? Obviously you want water to be able to get in. You don't want to put something down that's going to, you know, not allow water to get around the tree itself. So is that mat, like you're talking about, like a, I don't know, like a one-way membrane type thing where water goes in, but it doesn't come back. It doesn't evaporate back through the barrier, exactly. I guess.
So something I didn't mention with the mat, it is a 3x3 foot mat and it doesn't have any holes besides a little X that's by the tube where the tube meets the mat. That way you can slide the mat over the tube, but it forces these roots when you plant a young tree to go that 3x3 foot area to find water. You see what I'm saying? So you want to water around the outside of the mat and moisture will stay under it, but it'll make those roots continue to reach out versus just stay under the mat. Okay. If you baby him.
I got you. That makes sense. Well, Frank, I appreciate your time coming on the show and talking trees with me. Definitely got some ideas working now in my mind on what I need to do here on my property. But for those, I guess, you know, if they want more information on wildlife trees and shrubs, or maybe you want to check out what you guys have available there at Morse Nursery, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah. So again, thanks for having me on the show, Brian. MorseNursery.com is our website. And for the show, we're actually going to do a special 15% off code on any order any listener puts in. You just need to put promo code NDA15 with that order. But yeah, check us out on MorseNursery.com. You can look into also our habitat design and planning, where we can actually come out to your property or even do a thing virtually with you. But the website's the best way to reach us. And then always feel free to call us and we can answer any questions you might have on planting or tree varieties.
All right, guys, that wraps up our interview with Frank Brock. Thanks so much for checking out this episode of the Deer Season 365 podcast. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the show. You know, you can find us on all the popular podcasting platforms like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and several more. So about anywhere you could listen to podcasts, you should be able to find us there. Or you can just go to deerassociation.com/podcast and subscribe directly from our website. Hey, we'd also love it if you take just a second to leave us a 5-star rating or a written review. You know, those both help us climb the podcasting charts and be more visible to future listeners. So we would appreciate any support you could give us there. For more information about the National Deer Association, you can visit our website, again, at deerassociation.com. From there, you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter and, hey, just enjoy some of our several hundred articles of free content right there on our website, covering everything from hunting strategy to food plots, habitat improvement, deer management, you name it. If it's deer hunting or deer management related, we got some good content right there on our website available to you. So check that out. And of course, you can always find us on all the popular social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at Deer Association. So again, thanks for listening to the Deer Season 365 podcast, the podcast where deer season never ends.